This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. As the AFL prepares for its grand final, one of its most successful clubs, Hawthorn, has been accused of separating its First Nations players from their families and pressuring one couple to terminate a pregnancy. The ABC has spoken to three First Nations players and their families who allege the club intimidated and separated them during the reign of Hawthorn's former premiership coach, Alistair Clarkson. An external review commissioned by Hawthorn has examined the experiences of First Nations players and staff. This story is from the ABC's national sport reporter, David Mark, and a warning. It contains some confronting details, and the names of the players and their partners have been changed, and actors have recreated their interviews to protect their identities.
The final siren sounds. It is a fabled third straight premiership for Hawthorn.
Under Alistair Clarkson's coaching, Hawthorn was a powerhouse of the AFL, winning four premierships. But the experiences of some First Nations players, as told to ABC Sport, and now outlined to the club in an external review, suggest Hawthorn's famous brand as the family club is a misnomer for some. When young draftee Ian's partner Amy reached the 12-week mark of her pregnancy, he thought the news would be welcomed at Hawthorn. Instead, he says a group of coaches, including Clarkson and his then head of coaching Chris Fagan, told him the pregnancy and relationship had to end.
Clarkson just leaned over me and demanded that I needed to get rid of my unborn child and my partner.
He said he was told to call Amy.
He seemed to be crying, and he quickly said that we needed to terminate the pregnancy and end the relationship. I'll never forget that phone call or the heartbreak I felt in that moment.
Ian says he was moved into a staff member's home and says he was forced to change his phone number. Amy kept the baby but didn't see Ian for 5 months.
Hawthorn says it's the family club, yet they tore ours apart.
Ian and Amy's relationship didn't survive the trauma, and his mental health has since suffered.
I've lost the love of the game. I've had suicide attempts. They broke me as a man, as a footballer, and as a family man.
When Zach arrived at Hawthorn, he and his partner Kylie were happiest together at home. But he says that didn't sit well with Clarkson, who wanted him to socialise more with the players. At a meeting with Clarkson, Fagan, and player development manager Jason Burt, Zach, in tears, revealed childhood trauma was the reason for his clean living lifestyle. He says he was told Kylie was holding him back, and when he revealed she was pregnant, was told the relationship had to end and that he needed to move out. He went to live with Bert and says Hawthorn insisted he change his phone number. 5 weeks later, Kylie miscarried. Zach recalls how he heard the news his partner had lost their baby.
Jason Burt came up to me at training and just mentioned it in a by-the-way kind of comment. He said, mate, Kylie had a miscarriage, but don't worry, she's fine and has good support.
The former players and their partners, ABC Sport, spoke to or contributed to a racism review commissioned by Hawthorn, which was delivered 2 weeks ago and shared with the AFL's integrity unit. The family stress they did not ask for the investigation and say it's brought up old traumas that's caused them serious distress. ABC Sport contacted Clarkson, Fagan and Burt to respond to the allegations raised. However, none of them replied to our questions. In a statement, Hawthorn says the review has, quote, raised disturbing historical allegations that require further investigation. The AFL released a statement saying the experiences outlined in the review are extremely serious and require full examination. It says it's finalising a process to investigate the allegations.
That report from David Mark and Russell Jackson, and you can see the full statements from Hawthorn and the AFL on the ABC website. And if you or anyone you know need help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Earlier this month, we heard how people with disabilities and their families in outback Queensland were struggling with a lack of services. There's no disability accommodation in the state central west, and in towns like Isisford and Longreach, there's no respite care. But community members have come up with some ideas about how to change that, and they're now hoping politicians will help. Danielle O'Neill reports.
Can I have a milkshake, please?
Okay, we should cut it up. In the outback Queensland town of Longreach, 11-year-old Jacob is busy learning the ropes at the local cafe.
How much, Mr. Shopkeeper?
$10.
$10 for a milkshake? Seems outrageous.
Jacob lives with Down syndrome. While he's just practicing for now, his mum and dad bought this cafe with the hope that when he gets older, he can work here.
We wanted him to have a life of purpose and meaning, and we needed him to still remain engaged with the community. I can actually see Jacob waiting tables and running meals and helping with the stock take.
While Jacob's mum, Leanne Kohler, hasn't yet applied to have her son in the National Disability Insurance Scheme, or NDIS, she's already concerned he mightn't be able to stay in Longreach because of the chronic lack of disability accommodation and respite care. While some support workers and services like speech pathology are available, she and other mums and dads are trying to attract more support through a local advocacy group called Outback Independent Living.
In a nutshell, it's about trying to establish housing, short-term, long-term, day respite, emergency respite, and access to better services for people with disabilities within the region, not just in Longreach, but within the region.
To help, Longreach Mayor Tony Rayner says the council will donate land so the state and federal governments could build a facility.
If you think of co-design, you know, the purpose of that is that we work together to create something that's suitable for our communities. And yes, we're not a Toowoomba or Brisbane or Rockhampton, but we very much deserve to have the same level of services our city cousins have. So there's no reason why we can't create such a housing facility out here in Western Queensland.
Leanne Kohler says while the National Disability Insurance Scheme comes up with individual plans, which rely on private service providers, it needs to think about how to help groups of people in regional areas.
The difference between the outback and the urban centres is that there are a lot of service providers and a lot of people with special needs, and they can pick and choose. In the outback, you've got no one to choose. So you need to come collectively together, go the co-op model. You know, it's like better buying power.
The Federal Minister for the NDIS, Bill Shorten, is promising to visit Longreach to discuss a potential pilot project. Back at Leanne Kohler's house, there's hope change may finally be in the air.
And they're not pipe dreams. With the right decisions, the vision can definitely happen. And if it can happen in Longreach, it could happen in any outback community.
Longreach mum and disability advocate Leanne Kohler ending that report from Danielle O'Neill. A short time ago, I asked the Federal Minister for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, Bill Shorten, about how the government might be able to help.
Well, I think there's a genuine problem. I was actually due to go to Longreach next week, but because of the Queen's passing, Parliament's now sitting, but I'll get there soon. But the Queensland Minister, Craig Crawford's, made me aware that in places such as Longreach and other remote and very remote parts of Australia, the housing services for people with disability are it's much thinner market than it is in the big cities.
The local council there is even willing to donate land to allow facilities to be built. How could the federal government possibly help?
Well, I think we can. We have thousands of people on the NDIS in remote and very remote Australia, but there's challenges with, they're able to get disability support, they're eligible, but they can't actually spend it. Now, I know normally the challenge with government expenditure is people spending it, but in this case, the challenge is people not spending it. I think that we can work with the council to look at how we encourage innovative solutions to deliver gaps in current services delivery.
Another idea that the Longreach community has come up with is perhaps getting the NDIS to consider a sort of a co-op arrangement, helping groups of people in regional areas rather than just organising individual plans. Does that idea have merit?
Well, I like the idea of an individualised scheme. That is, individuals get support based on their own circumstances. Having said that, in a place such as Longreach, what we found is that when the NDIS became available, we used to think there were about 24 out of 1,000 people who were receiving disability services. With the arrival of the NDIS, it's gone up to north of 50 people. So there was unmet need, which the NDIS is now meeting. However, there's a challenge when you bring services to Longreach that if you're flying in allied health professionals or different services for individuals, that's a very costly way to do it. So I am interested in how, if you like, you have the individuals still have their package, but by using analysing big data, by talking to councils and local service providers, there might be an economy of scale where the person with the disability package shops through the particular co-op to get the service, which means that the co-op organises the service rather than the individual.
A parent recently told us they moved from Longreach to Brisbane reluctantly because there were just no services for their child. Should regional communities feel let down that they're not getting the same sort of services as they would in the city? We're talking about Longreach, but there are many other places in across Australia who experience the same sort of thing.
In an ideal world, you wouldn't have to move. But I think this is one of the challenges of life in small town Australia. How do we make sure that people can not have to be forced to move to big cities? I can't sort out all the challenges of remote and regional Australia across all services. But when it comes to the NDIS, I think we can afford to be innovative. If councils who deliver services are they're there on the ground, maybe there is something we can do to make sure that we encourage people who have common aspects of their individual packages to see if we can't create an economy of scale in the local community so that that money is spent in the local community and the service is delivered from within the local community rather than fly in, fly out.
The Treasury yesterday revealed a $50 billion windfall to the budget bottom line. Will you get a slice of that to help fund these extra services, given that long-term sustainability of the scheme is an issue?
Well, what's good about the NDIS is it's demand-driven. So whatever the Treasury was going to come up with, the NDIS wasn't at risk. Our challenge is to make sure that the money's being spent well. We have to look at the NDIS as being an investment in people, not a cost. Our challenge is to make sure that there's cost-effective services being delivered. But Jim Chalmers and the whole government are committed to making sure that people with disability get their funding.
And that issue of siphoning off money, how are you going to tackle that?
I think there's several ways. One, at the extreme end, I think there's fraud in the scheme. And I don't mean a person in a wheelchair getting a special cushion for their wheelchair. It's not the person with a disability, I mean. It's organised crime. But I also think there's a challenge of waste of money, where we've got bureaucratic processes which lead to money being wasted, decisions being delayed. There's also the issue of overcharging and overservicing, where you might have some service providers, and many of them are good, I should say, but some are charging hundreds of dollars per hour for services, which is just extortionate robbery. So I think there's a combination of methods we can do. The other thing is that the old government spent a lot of time arguing with people with disability about the actual whether or not they were eligible. I think what we've got is an opportunity to put greater rigor around the payment system. So when an invoice is submitted, we want to make sure that it's not an inflated invoice or that, in fact, the service has been delivered.
All right. Mr. Shorten, thanks for talking to AM.
Good morning, Sabra.
Bill Shorten is the Federal Minister for the National Disability Insurance Scheme. The COVID pandemic's having some devastating consequences for a remote Aboriginal community in Queensland. Health experts are blaming it for delays in treating chronic health conditions. They're concerned about a rising number in deaths, which means even the local cemetery is running out of space. Jade Toomey reports.
On Palm Island, just off the coast of Townsville, streets empty and businesses close when members of the Aboriginal community have sorry business.
The community is under a lot of stress and a lot of pressure.
Local resident Gavin Kongu says there's been a funeral on the island almost every week this year.
It affects us in a big way, especially the elders. They've never seen so much death in such a short period of time. And there was one part, it was like two funerals a week. We just could not get a break.
At least 40 people have died on Palm Island this year, the majority from chronic disease or suicide. Mayor Mislam Sam says the delay in treating chronic disease is catching up with his community.
For a community with a population roughly between 3,000 to 4,000 people and having at least 50 funerals per year, those kinds of stats is unheard of. When you're constantly lining up, paying your respects and all that, it's taking its toll on a lot of community members.
Dr. Jason Agostino is a senior medical advisor at the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation. He says Indigenous Australians are encouraged to get screened annually for chronic disease, but that number halved during the pandemic.
What we're concerned about is that means that people won't have chronic conditions picked up early and might get it picked up later when they're already a bit sick.
Palm Island endured an 11-week lockdown this year, and Dr. Agostino says that affected the number of health workers available.
If it's harder to get an appointment, if it's more difficult to see people that know you, then managing your chronic disease becomes more complicated.
With the deaths, there's another complication. The island cemetery has filled up faster than expected. Lex Watton is a former cemetery worker.
We're burying people on top of one another. It's hard to try and control, but there are a lot of health problems.
Mayor Mislam Sam says the council's investigating where a new cemetery can be built.
We're going to have, you know, community conversations in regards to where are alternative sites into the future. We've already started that process.
For residents like Gavin Kongu, it's a dilemma that's important to be resolved.
To be buried and to be back on country is something special, and that's where our ancestors are. There's no place like home.
Palm Island resident Gavin Kongu ending Jade Toomey's report. The wildflowers of Western Australia's Midwest are in full bloom at the moment, and that means more tourists than usual are roaming the quiet pastoral region. While locals are happy to welcome the visitors, they're also worried they could pose a biosecurity risk. Joe Prendergast explains.
After years of drought, Gemma Cripps is enjoying watching her sheep and cattle graze on lush grass and wildflowers on her station at Yalgoo, 200 kilometres inland from the WA port city of Geraldton. But along with wild dogs, the weather and meat prices, the threat of foot and mouth disease is keeping her up at night.
At the moment, we'd like to increase our sheep numbers, but that risk is definitely something that we think about a lot.
While Gemma Cripps and her family run a farm stay on their property, they're worried that uninvited visitors could unwittingly bring in foot and mouth disease. With several public roads running through the property, she says people often assume they can explore and camp without permission.
We have a lot of prospecting and bird watching photographers that don't really understand the risks of their actions. I'm not quite sure how we're going to manage the biosecurity risk.
How often would you find someone or evidence of someone being on your property without your consent?
Weekly, easily weekly.
Up the road, Greg Payne runs goats on his pastoral property. He's also the Yalgoo Shire president.
The tourist dole is very important for us as a Shire-owned caravan park. That helps with us, but then we've got a couple of businesses in town that helps support. And then there's also some of the outlying stations that have got station stays and that.
But he's also worried about the risk of travellers bringing disease, and he's appealing for people to consider biosecurity when planning a trip out bush.
Do a bit of background. If you're coming onto a pastoralist, you need to ring the pastoralist and see if they have a biosecurity measures in place that they'd like you to follow.
Back at Gabion Station, while some travellers are being asked to wash their shoes and suitcases before entering the property, Gemma Cripps still wants to make them feel welcome.
When you've got people here and you've got to point out to them all the cool spots, you tend to just forget about how amazing they are. And having people here to explain and talk to, it helps to remind you how lucky we are to be able to be here too.
Yalgoo pastoralist Gemma Cripps sending that report from Joe Prendergast. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.